Hello, everyone. Welcome to our session today. It's late in the week. We all survived last night's party. What time did everybody get in? About 4 a.m. this morning? Yeah. I am here today with Sham. My name is William Cornwell. I'm a collaboration TSP with Microsoft Australia. I look after SharePoint technologies for all of Australia and all the Pacific Islands. We're going to talk about high-octane websites in the SharePoint platform. So I'll let Sham introduce himself first.
Yeah, my name is Sham Narayan, and I'm a solutions architect with Kyandra IT based out of Melbourne. I'm also a collaboration platform VTSP with Microsoft.
Right. So during the session today, I've got a couple of textbooks here. These are a good little book. It's got nothing to do with web content management, but I thought I'd bring it along anyway. So it's by an author called Ira Fuchs. He's the same role as me out of the New York office in America, obviously. It's called Enterprise Application Development in SharePoint 2010 Without Writing Any Code. So they're quite good books. I've also got a free ticket to the Australian SharePoint conference in March next year to give away as well, with about $700. During the session, if you've got access to tweet, just tweet with our hash code for our session, OFS 307. We'll be monitoring on the slate here, and we can answer the questions at the end of the session, which we've allowed some time towards the end of the session to answer all the questions that you might have during the session. All right, so the next thing we want to do is talk about the why. Why would you want to do some web content management, and why would you choose SharePoint? Traditionally, a lot of organizations are still running version one sort of websites, where the experience that you've got is around virtualizing basically a brochure and pushing it out to customers to try and get your information out to them in a glossy way. Right? There's not really the attraction, the stickiness. Why do I want to go back to the customer's website? Why do I want to visit that information? Is it just about the information on the website? And there's a whole heap of other things that goes into factoring that. This is some of the trends we're seeing, right? So we've got things like new expectations and demands from end users around understanding that they want to see more information, they want to see it more visually, they want to see videos, they want to actually be able to go in and manipulate the product and view it and see it differently. They also want to be able to access the information from many more channels, you know, Slate devices, Windows phones, iPhones, iPads, in-shop display windows, on a desktop, in a mobile sense, anywhere they want. So there's a lot more different channels that we need to actually target it out. There's also a whole heap of things around social networking. To give an example, I bought a digital camera just recently. I bought a Canon digital camera. Why did I buy Canon? Because when I asked the people in my social network on Facebook, what digital camera does everybody like, the majority of my social network came back and said digital camera from Canon, right? So I went and bought that one. Not to say that it's the best or not, but it's the one that my social friends and pool recommended. Why is that important? Well, I can borrow all their lenses. I can borrow all their filters. I can start to do all that sort of stuff without having to go out and buy all my own stuff. And so it became a bit more of a play around that sort of stuff. So having access to reviews, having access to your social network and friends and information about the products that you're pitching on your website and how to connect it into those social networks and bring that information in is something that's becoming more of a demand from your end, from the end users. Users are highly selective and they actually want to understand the different feature sets and, as I said, view and manipulate images and get 360-degree views of the information and that they're trying to look at on a website as well. And they want it to be more user-centric. They want the experience to be their experience. They want to go to the website. They want to be recommended products that they want. They want to be seeing information that they want to see, and they want to have the experience feeling that when they go to the website, it's a website experience for them. Right. So these are some of the challenges that we're starting to look at around web content management. So today we're actually going to go through three sections. We're going to first of all take a look under the cover of SharePoint and actually have a look at what the web content management framework consists of, what are the things that the developers I'm assuming there's a lot of developers in the room, need to be mindful of when they're looking at building web content management solutions. The second thing we're going to look at, we're going to look at best practices in that section is around some tooling as well. The next thing is, once you've actually looked at what you can do in web content management, how do you take it to the next level and build this interactive website that the customer is wanting at the other end? right? So how do we integrate it with technologies like Commerce Server for shopping cart experiences and check-in, check-out and those sort of things? How do we take SharePoint and create a personalised framework where we can target content to specific individuals based on how they've been here before and other information around that person? And then the next thing we're going to look at is going that extra mile. Once you've built all this stuff, how do you then get the reach? How do you get the scale? So how do you target people with accessibility needs? How do you make sure that people on low bandwidth connections can still visit your website and performance comes into important in there? And how do you use something like the Windows Azure, I'll say Azure, Azure Cloud to really scale up your solution and take advantages of some of this new cloud-based technology instead of building everything on-premise. So let's have a look at the under the hood first, which is around the tooling, the best practices, and what web content management is. So Sean, you're going to show us a little bit about the web content management solution.
Yep.
So do you want to flick over and show us that sort of stuff? This one here.
Okay. What I'm going to do is quickly walk you guys through a web content management system running on top of SharePoint. So I'm going to fire up Internet Explorer and just go through what an end user is going to experience on a typical brochureware website running on SharePoint. That's a SharePoint 2010 website branded for a customer-facing scenario. Okay, we've got the typical external-facing site with the top navigation running up the top. We've got, you know, we've broken the sites into subsets. So this is all using the standard SharePoint framework underneath the hood. We've also got we also got options to use the out-of-the-box SharePoint search to actually search through the site. But what I actually want to show you is actually what the content authoring experience is like when you're managing a site like this. I'm going to jump into Firefox and quickly just authenticate myself. So in this case, I'm actually, as a content author, logged in. I'm using Firefox to do this. And what we want to show you is the out-of-the-box experience, which we have maintained even with a totally custom-branded website. So in this case, I've thrown the page into edit mode. I get the WYSIWYG editing. I can click into areas and start adding in content. And I can see how this page is going to be rendered once I publish it out to the internet. I also got specific content areas that are locked and basically controlled so that the content author cannot go outside these bounds. So I'm just going to go put in a note, a byline out there, powered by SharePoint 2010, save that. So you can see it's picked up the branding. It's in a proper controlled area in the SharePoint site. So it gives us that quick fidelity of editing SharePoint, actually web pages, the same experience that you get in rich clients such as Word and Excel. I'm also going to go create a new page and call it careers. So it's going to go create a new page in the content database. I'm going to swap over and change the page layout. So page layouts are essentially templates. Probably use that one. Content. That's some more. Save this. So this is typically a scenario that a content author would be doing on SharePoint. Also going to use the navigation control and add in a new navigation. I'm going to call it. Browse for that page. Save that. Yep, careers has come up. I can browse to that. And you can actually run it through a publishing workflow, so it goes through a series of steps of approval before it gets published out to the internet. What I'm going to do in this case is just use a partial script which actually publishes this site out for me. It's going to go do and look at pages that are checked out and actually publish it in. Okay, that's done. You can see it's actually published out. I can jump back into my Internet Explorer. This is where the anonymous user is browsing the site You can see careers has been added into the navigation. And it's really simple for content authors to actually start creating pages and managing content on SharePoint. We've kept it as close to the out-of-the-box editing experience. And the intention of this demo, it wasn't a very technical demo. It was more what an end user would do or a content author would do. But the intention was more to highlight what we as developers need to cater for. So the whole idea is that we need to give end users this capability as a platform so they can go build sites on top of SharePoint 2010.
So we're going to cover off a couple of areas of the web content management framework. Really, these four areas. There's a lot of different areas that you need to consider. But these are probably the main areas that you need to think about when you're developing WCM solutions. The publishing infrastructure, everything that needs to be done around taking content, approving pages, whether you author content and then publish it out to a public-facing environment or whether you have it authored on that public-facing environment. So the staging sort of scenarios. Understanding navigation and all the elements of what is provided out of the box and what you can bring to SharePoint on top of navigation. Concepts around field controls and field types, we're going to cover that off. And also some common thoughts around whether you use ASP.NET components or whether you use web parts and when to web part and when not to web part. So we'll touch on those. So Sham, did you want to talk about publishing infrastructure?
Okay, we keep hearing this term publishing infrastructure. So what is it? So basically, the publishing infrastructure is a set of features which gets installed onto your SharePoint server when you deploy SharePoint. It only is available with SharePoint Server, and it's not available with SharePoint Foundation. So what does the publishing infrastructure entail of? It basically consists of a set of features which get activated when you go create a new site using the publishing site definition. So when you go create a new site using central admin, it actually uses and activates those features and adds in the required prerequisites and framework elements so that we can go build internet-facing sites on SharePoint 2010. So there are two main features that actually do most of the heavy lifting, and I actually would recommend, highly recommend, that if you've got access to a development or a test environment, go into the SharePoint root directory and look at the publishing features and what they do. It's very, very important because there's a whole bunch of features which are tied together by something called as feature activation, which makes all this thing happen seamlessly behind the scenes. And it's very important when we get into customizations that you understand the sequence of execution. So from an anatomy basis, the two big features are called publishing web and publishing site. So the publishing web features is probably the most important feature and does the least amount of work. All it does is go and activate publishing site. And that's the first feature which gets called. And the publishing site, in turn, goes and activates a whole set of other features which adds in the required prerequisites. So it goes in and adds in the list infrastructure. It adds in the publishing framework prerequisites. So when we start talking about publishing, we start talking about site columns, content types, page layouts. These things are actually provisioned by the publishing site feature. It also goes and adds in a few more navigation components. Like you saw how I was managing navigation, this is only available when you turn on publishing and it's not available in non-publishing sites. And what else does this feature do? There's one particular feature called as the publishing layouts feature, which basically goes in and provisions the out-of-the-box master pages and the branding elements. So when you go create a publishing site out of the box, it has the nice blue color, which AdventureWorks branding, that's actually done through that feature. Another important thing, it provisions all the web parts. Using, especially for publishing sites, we use web parts such as content query and table of contents and summary links. These gets provisioned during the site activation when those features are turned on. As a developer, when you start building sites, one common thing that you notice is that you need to set up a site constantly from central administration. Then you use either something like SharePoint Designer to go customize it. And it's a very manual and labor-intensive process. So the right way to customize so that you can get this repeatable process is to use something called as web templates in SharePoint 2010. There was a session on Wednesday, which was covered by Brian Farnell and Elaine Van Bergen, where they actually went very deep into this concept. So if you have not been to that session, I would highly recommend viewing it on TechEd Online. It covers all these concepts in great detail. I'm not going to jump into it, but I'm just recommending that when we want to customize publishing sites, we use the web templates approach. The next big thing is navigation. internet-facing sites, navigation, basically make or break the site. It starts off with your information architecture planning. From that time, you need to start thinking about how users are going to navigate around your site. Poor navigation, both from a performance perspective and from a navigation perspective, can basically turn away users from your site. So you need to make sure that the navigation works absolutely perfectly. And SharePoint does provide something out of the box which makes this easy. So it basically provides us navigation providers, which are built on top of the ASP.NET provider model, which shipped with .NET 2.0. And it adds on top of that. And with the publishing framework, there is something called as a specific provider called as the Portal Sitemap Provider, which is built for internet-facing sites. It's got an inbuilt caching mechanism built into it, which allows us to actually build large website with scale in mind. So customizations. In out-of-the-box, I showed you one of the navigation control. That's an out-of-the-box navigation control which ships with SharePoint. We've just used CSS to style it up. In 2010, the actual navigation control has been rewritten to actually emit much more friendlier markup. In the MOS 2007 world, we had tables and basically CSS and JavaScript trying to render out menus. In this case, it's basically unordered list and CSS hover state. So you can basically control the look and feel using CSS, which makes it much more designer-friendly. This might be most of the scenarios when you would probably get away with customizing just the out-of-the-box navigation. But sometimes you really want to get into a bit more of high-end navigation. An example of that would be the Ferrari website, which we'll show you later on, which actually has a really interesting navigation where you hover over a link and it blows out and shows you a mega menu. That's what we're calling it nowadays, mega menu, which basically shows a lot more content hidden behind a single link. So when you start building navigation components like what we have on Ferrari, you would probably, again, start looking at the portal sitemap provider. What the portal sitemap provider gives you is querying options. So if you're familiar with SP query and SP site data query, you can actually issue that query to the portal sitemap provider. It will go execute that query and cache it for you. So that way you're automatically keeping performance at the back of your mind without writing custom code. We also show you another scenario when we get into the commerce server bits where we have customized navigation again. The next big thing, field controls and field types. This probably is the nucleus of your publishing framework. At the core of SharePoint, this is what which holds everything together. And in publishing sites, this is the differentiating factor. When I jumped into a page and started editing content in place, that's what we are using behind the scenes is field types and field controls. And this is different from a standard collaboration site or a standard team site where you generally use these controls to add content to a list or modify content on a list. In this case, we're actually modifying content that's going to be rendered out as HTML on the internet. So that's the big differentiating factor in the way field types and controls are used in the context of publishing. A common question that I keep getting asked is, in page layouts, why can't we use web paths to actually manage content? You can do it. There's nothing stopping you from doing it. But you always got to keep in mind the content that gets authored in a web part is always managed aside and stored separate from the list infrastructure. So when you use field controls to manage content, it actually gets stored against the list. You automatically get versioning. You automatically get workflows against that. Whereas as soon as you go into a web part, it's out. So if you need versioning and auditing and you want to go back and forth in time, please stick to field control. So use that as a tip when you want to move between or pick and choose between field controls and web paths. And also, I spoke about the marriage between field controls and page layouts. Page layouts are essentially templates. This concept has been brought over from the times of content management server. And this is what allows you to basically take site columns and basically create a content type which mimics your page structure and then place them on page layouts to allow content ordering. The final thing, web paths. Again, there is no right or wrong answer to whether you need to use web paths or not. It basically comes down to your need. Like, I generally prefer not to use web paths on internet-facing sites if there is a need for really controlling the branding. But if you need flexibility where end users might personalize their pages, web paths would be the way to go. But you need to keep in mind, when you're building web paths, it needs to fit back into the overall branding and color scheme. So that's it gets a bit tricky, but you need to keep that at the back of your mind. And also web parts versus ASP.NET controls. When do I pick which over? The general rule of thumb that I follow and we suggest is use web parts when you want to package information, give it to someone, and where you don't have control over where they might use it in a site collection. If you know that you're going to use something in one place, do not go build a web part. Use an ASP.NET control because the overhead is unwarranted. And finally, web parts for internet sites. There are some, like I said, when the publishing feature gets activated, there are a few web parts that get added to the web part gallery, namely the summary links control, the table of content, and most importantly, the content by query web part. Content by query web part is probably one of the most powerful and flexible web parts in SharePoint, which allows you to do a whole lot of stuff. Now, if you want to roll content up from multiple sites in your site collection, content query is the way to go. And what content query does underneath the hood is basically use, again, a caching mechanism. It uses a bit of the portal sitemap provider to give you data back in XML. And then you style it using XSLT to control the output. So a lot of the internet sites, especially SharePoint sites like Ferrari and SharePoint, Microsoft SharePoint site itself, have these banners that keep changing on the homepage. That's basically implemented using content by query web part. Or you typically start seeing the top five news. You know, you have top five news rolled up on your homepage. These are scenarios where you would start using content by query web part. So we spoke about four things, the four pillars of web content management. But now we need tooling. We need a set of guidelines to actually make and accelerate the process so that we can stick to these four pillars and make them absolutely rock solid. So we can start building a platform on top of that. So what we've decided to talk to you about is some best practices. And when we mean best practices, it's a set of tools. So what tools do we generally use? What processes to follow? Okay, we're going to walk you through a checklist, a very quick checklist, which is, again, these things vary depending on projects. And finally, we want to talk to you about some components.
Yep.
Okay. So SP development tools. So what tools do SharePoint developers generally need to use on their machine? I'm just going to flick over. Actually jump into Visual Studio.
True developers, eh?
I lost my mouse. Okay. Seem to have lost my mouse. There you go. That's fine. So first thing, Visual Studio 2010. With the release of Visual Studio 2010, a new project template was added, which allows us to create SharePoint 2010 projects. If you're not using Visual Studio 2010, no, I'll have to probably hang on for a tick. Yep, got it. Awesome. And you'd see a new node that pops up, which allows us to create new SharePoint projects. I'm just going to go create a new one, call it OFS307. I'm going to deploy this as a farm solution. So it's giving me options to deploy as a sandbox solution or as a farm solution. Okay, I'm just going to switch over to Solution Explorer. This is good. Good experience out of the box. I can start adding web parts, start adding visual web parts, packaging things up. But I generally prefer using an additional tool on top of this called a CKS Dev. How many of you all use CKS Dev? It's a community-driven initiative which basically provides you with additional tooling on top of the out-of-the-box stuff. I'm just going to walk you through some features that it provides. It provides a server explorer. So I can go build something on my server, start exploring it. It basically breaks down my SharePoint site and shows me the components underneath that. In this case, it's pulling out all the content types that the site has got. So if you go create a site manually, if you want to really start accelerating SharePoint site creation, you can go create a site manually and then use these tools to actually extract it. So basically, you get a reverse engineering tool without having to write nasty camel by hand. Who likes to write camel?
No, not really.
Love it. Another, I'm just going to quickly reverse engineer something so I can actually build on top of that. I'm just going to go import that content type. So it's going to go add notes to my Visual Studio, and it's added the right packages. You don't want to be writing that by hand. Okay. Another thing, there are times when you just can't automate certain XML creation. There's another tool available which we prefer to use. It's called as camel.net. Who's heard about camel.net?
Couple.
Yep. Yeah. Again, an open project put together by an MVP called as John Holiday, which provides IntelliSense for Camel. So I can now go in and start typing, and it starts giving me IntelliSense. Each and every item in there has got comments against that. And John has actually gone through and added his own comments. And it also has got links out to the actual MSDN libraries in certain areas. So you can click directly, go to the MSDN online reference, and have a look at what it is. So it gives you a good way to actually create Camel by hand using IntelliSense. This is what we call predominantly you would be doing from a server side. So when you're building Visual Studio in deep dive developer land, this is what you would be doing. But when it comes to building WCM sites, you start looking at and interacting with the browser extremely frequently. And there are toolings provided by some of the major browser vendors at the moment, which allow you to actually inspect what's being sent down to the client. I'm just going to fire up Firefox. So these tools are even built into Internet Explorer. I'm just going to use
Firefox.
You didn't
think you'd see that in the Microsoft presentation, did you?
And I'm actually going to go to the Ferrari website. Okay. What you can see at the bottom is basically page statistics. It's actually going through, and as the page is getting downloaded, looking at things and giving you an indication of what's happening on that page. This you can use further, which will show how to use this to basically optimize and improve your page rendering process. You can also go look at things like the CSS that got rendered, the JavaScript. It just gives you good client-side capability.
Who knew that this was SharePoint 2010? Oh, good, our marketing's working.
Also, another tool that I use which runs within the browser is called as Wyslow. Who uses Wyslow to optimize websites? That's awesome. Yeah, Wyslow, again, it's a tool by Yahoo. What it does is basically goes out, looks at your page, and tells you what you need to do so you can scale better. In this case, it's actually telling me that there are 6 CSS classes. Reduce them and compress them into one file so you're not making too many HTTP requests. There are 4 JavaScripts saying if you can compress it, it's better. It gives you some good guidelines around web optimization, which you can follow. And I'll show you how we're going to use this to actually optimize an internet-facing site. Okay. Yeah, we got one more thing, which I want to demo. Okay.
Demo it first.
Who likes PowerShell? Okay, who likes the out-of-the-box PowerShell editor that ships with Windows? Okay, thought so. Okay, there's a tool called as PowerGUI, again, open source driven, which gives you to edit and basically debug PowerShell with IntelliSense. And the Visual Studio has spoiled us all, and we no longer can write code in Notepad or WordPad. We really need things with IntelliSense. This basically gives you IntelliSense for writing PowerShell. So when you actually want to get into some good practices, you need tooling to support you. Otherwise, the barrier to entry to doing things correct is too high, and you generally don't do it. Okay, let's flip back. We spoke about tooling. Now we need to use these tools in a specific way to actually get the most out of it. Okay? So when we speak about process, I'm a big agile freak. I like to do things agile. I like the iteration and the high-performance team culture. As part of these processes, there are a few things that you can do which will basically greatly enhance your quality and consistency in delivering high-quality solutions. One of them that I think is automation. Who now uses automated SharePoint builds and continuous integration in SharePoint projects? Does anyone do that at the moment? I can see a few hands, which is awesome. With Visual Studio 2010 and Team Foundation Server 2010, this process has been really improved. With a few clicks, you can now pump out solution packages on the server really effectively. So you can basically have a big team working on a SharePoint project, having a continuous integration build going. So as soon as anyone changes anything, checks it back into SharePoint, build gets triggered, boom, you have a WSP package ready to be triggered. You can automate the versioning. It just gives you that good comfort factor that you are actually pumping out high-quality builds.
So we're pumping out these high-quality builds. What do we do with them afterwards?
Yep, that's a really good question. I've seen teams where we have done continuous integration, and we haven't done anything after that. So we have a successful build, that's about it. So the whole idea of continuous integration is to get quick feedback saying, oh, something worked, something didn't work. At SharePoint, it gets a bit more tricky. You need to go deploy this. And that's where Power GUI and PowerShell are your friends. I recommend, and we've done this on a recent project, where we've actually used TFS to pump out builds and then gone and scripted out the entire deployment process using PowerShell. It might be a bit complicated initially, and once you've done it, it's basically a cookie-cutter sort of an approach. You can just parameterize it and use it again and again on projects. And what this does is you have a WSP, gets deployed on a target SharePoint environment, and you have a site up and running every time something changes.
Fantastic. You wouldn't
do this for a small site. So if it's a project where you're working for a week and a half, you wouldn't do it. This is talking about a fairly large SharePoint project.
Hmm. So that's good. Now we've got our deployment happening,
yep,
and it's out there. How do we test?
Yep.
Test the UI, make sure things haven't broken,
yep,
that sort of stuff.
Okay. I like TDD. How many people write unit tests? That's good. Much more than the time I asked last time. How many people write unit tests for SharePoint? Oh, that's really awesome.
That's
really awesome. Okay. The barrier to entry in unit testing itself is high. With SharePoint, it just gets even harder. The object model doesn't easily facilitate writing unit tests. So you need to look at mocking frameworks such as TypeMock or Microsoft PexInmol. And there is a bit of overhead to that. Now we've got automated builds and a site deploy. We need some way of actually testing these scenarios out so we can somehow get some good coverage and early feedback again during our builds. What I'm going to show you is using Visual Studio to automate your UI tests and run them as part of your build. So I'm not going to actually do the build process, just show you what the automated testing looks like. Okay, I'm just going to close this solution down. Okay. So I've got this really complex web part which takes in an email address and goes and registers you for some spam. And I want to, you know, generally newsletters are spam. I registered once where I couldn't unregister. Let's not get there. Okay, so this is basically a scenario where we've got requirements saying if the email address is not entered, you need to give a validation message saying, you know, you need your email address to continue. And if it's successful, try and register the user. What I've done is I've created tests basically manually. So you can run up a macro recorder in Visual Studio and actually record your UI actions and then generate code out of it. It gets generated out as a C# class, so you can actually go ahead and tweak it if required, but just be careful when you're tweaking it. But it just gives you an easy way to generate out tests which can be run again and again. So especially when you're working with workflows, filling out those big forms, you generally have test in all fields and basically garbage numbers. You don't want that. You want your analysts and testers to actually put proper data in there once and then reuse that again and again. You're making use of what you've done. So what I'm going to do, I'm just going to fire up one test and run this test. So this is going to fire up and automatically fire up my Internet Explorer. It's going to load up my site. It might be a bit slow. I didn't warm this up.
It's a very complex looking site too.
Yeah. And look, Ma, no hands. Got a Kinect receiver up there.
See, looks fairly complex, doesn't it?
So it's basically gone and it's tried to register without an email address and it's come back and said the test has passed because we got a validation message. I got another test which basically now pops in an email address and it expects the test to work. It's passing. It's given, yes, you've successfully registered. Test has passed. Yeah. Now, when we generally have user stories or requirements, they have multiple scenarios. So you generally start off with saying, you know, you try and register. If no email address, give a validation message. If the user supplies a proper email address, go register the user. And you want to order them. So Visual Studio gives you an option of ordering them as well and executing them as a batch. So in this case, it's going to go run all my tests that I've got recorded and give me an output. So it basically allows me to regression test an entire requirement. In that case, it said the entire requirement has passed at the moment. And I'll quickly show you. We as developers like to comment stuff. I'm just going to comment this line off, which basically...
Get rid of the validator. That's a good one.
And I'm using CKSDev to actually copy this file into SharePoint. Okay, I'm going to close that. Go back to my test and run my test. It's going to try and run the test again. It's going to fail. And we'll go look at what it tells us. Yep, test failed. If I go drill into that, it's the first test that has failed. And it's actually telling us we were trying to assert against that text, and that was not available on the UI. You can put any kind of assertion. So if you're used to unit testing, you would be familiar with the three A's, arrange, act, and assert. You can do the same thing using coded UI tests. Yep. Yeah. So we spoke about getting coded UI tests running. Now, you want something which is defined as an exit criteria to make sure that as developers are finishing features, you can actually tick them off properly and getting it to 100% complete. Features that are 90% complete are more detrimental than features that are 0% complete. And most of the time in development, you have features which are 90 to 95% complete, and you always go back to them to complete them. So I generally like to have something called as the done checklist or the exit criteria, and it depends on what kind of project you're working on. So some of the standard stuff, like, are you ensuring that sharpened objects are disposed? You know, are you using CAML properly? You know, it's just ensuring things like that. But there are a few things that I really think developers should look at. One of that is testing for scale. If you are building out an internet site and expecting around 1,000 users to hit your site every minute, you need to test that. And the only way to test out and figure out the bottlenecks in your code is to have a structured testing approach. There is a tool called as Hammerhead, which I couldn't show you today because it works with an older version of Firefox, which basically looks at a web page, sends requests with different network latency, and gives you an idea of how your web page is going to behave when people from all over the world access your website. It's a really lightweight tool, and it's really important to do such testing, because unless all your user bases hold up in your server room, there is going to be network latency. Visual Studio also gives you testing options. It is only available with the Ultimate Edition, where you can actually have proper stress testing applied against your SharePoint environment. So you can have users, 100 users hit your site, do an action, or 2,000 users use your site, and collect the metrics from that and see what are the bottlenecks to go improve your SharePoint code base.
So Sham and I put together a couple of components. There's a web content management web template, a model view presenter integration component, automated testing project with all the definitions ready to go. Later on, we're going to show you some stuff about optimizing page weight and also integrating with App Fabric in the Azure cloud. Basically, what we're going to do is we're going to package all this up as a zip file and make it available on our blogs. We'll give you our blogs a little bit later. So you'll be able to go back to the office and basically download this and start going with this sort of stuff straight from day one. All right, so we've seen under the hood, looked at the WCM framework, a couple of things that make it up, end-user stuff, some developer stuff, some best practices around some of the tooling and some of the open source stuff, which makes things a little bit easier for us. So we're still at the brochureware stage, right? We're still building websites. What are we doing with those websites? We're still pushing information out that authors are creating for our end users, right? So how do we take it to the next level? How do we start to build, commerce server delivery platforms using the SharePoint, you know, hooking up with commerce server? And how do we personalize this information? So let's look at turbocharging the environment. First thing we're going to look at is integrating with Commerce Server 2009 R2. We're using the release candidate version of that, but I believe it's close, if not already gone to RTM. So watch the space, it's pretty close. So Sham, do you want to give us a run of that? We've built this great website. It's called the Sham Wheel Guys. It's a travel adventures website where we sell products to customers around camping and all that sort of stuff. So over to you, Sean.
Yep. Still haven't got the images finalized on it, which is coming. Okay. So what we've got, this is a SharePoint site running Commerce Server. It's integrated into Commerce Server. We've got the typical e-commerce scenario going. We've got the catalog running across the left. So I can click into the catalog. Brings up my items that are available for sale. These items are managed natively in Commerce Server. So you can have your business users manage the catalog and the inventory in Commerce Server. There are specific applications which ship with Commerce Server, which allows you to do that. I can go look at the item, and it gives me information. I can go write a review. This is where bringing the social side of things together. I can go add it to my cart, and it shows up at the top. It's added to my cart. I can go click into my cart and proceed for checkout. This is a fairly standard type of scenario you would expect on an e-commerce website. Now, this is all running on top of SharePoint 2010 at the moment. What I've got, this is an anonymous user. I can go create an account and put in my credit card details. It's all securely managed. It'll go out and put in the order for me. But what I want to show you as well is the authoring environment. So this is basically what an internal user would see. So an internal user has got access to the ribbon because he's authenticated. We've got a Silverlight application running, which allows me to do things directly against Commerce Server in a really quick way, which I'll show you. So for example, if I drill into Boots again, I've got Dunes. And now if I go into my Commerce Server actions, hit edit, this is going to load up a Silverlight widget for me to start managing my catalog straight from SharePoint. I can make any changes over here. It gets pushed back into Commerce Server and refreshes the entire site. This allows me to in-place manage content from SharePoint. It also gives me a couple of other really nifty options to actually manage marketing. And a lot of times you would have things where you want to cross-sell stuff or you want to upsell something to a user. In this case, it allows you to do that as well. You can go in there, you know, generally with Boots, I want to get pants. Okay, it's brought back a list. I can add it to my collection, save it. So every time a user comes and makes searches for Boots, it's going to suggest pants for him as well. So this way I can really quickly start managing these things. This can be managed natively in Commerce Server and also in SharePoint 2010.
Yeah, just before we do, there's also a whole other section of Commerce Server which we're not going to show today, but it's about the advertising framework, right? So you can actually create ads, you can target those ads to individuals. You know, people that have purchased Boots before, you might want to target pants to them next time they come to the website. So you can be very prescriptive about that sort of thing as well. Do you want to do that?
Yep. So with what I showed you was Commerce Server 2009 RC, R2, which is running in RC mode. But what are the features that make this integration possible? Okay. So what with Commerce Server 2007, there was a big push from the community saying we want to use SharePoint as the UI model to deliver commerce to our online users. There was a big push, and the Commerce Server team paid a lot of attention. And with the 2009 release, released an integration pack, which basically provided you with all the functionality we saw straight out of the box. So you could go, it gave you a site template which you could go create a site with, and it gave you around 30 web parts which provided most of the commerce functions. So and if you look at commerce, it would be mostly around your profile management, how to add users, how to reset their passwords, how to manage their account information, shipping address, how to manage my catalog, how to manage search. All these things were built and shipped with the 2009 release, and again with the 2009 R2 release. This has been further improved to support claims-based authentication. Out-of-the-box features, I spoke about 30 web parts. It basically builds on something called as the Commerce Foundation API, which is a WCF service, which allows unified access into the back-end commerce subsystems. Now, what you saw was out-of-the-box. It doesn't take more than an hour to get that up and going. So it's really quick. You can start getting integration going. But you typically wouldn't take that and run that on a production website. So how would you go customize these web parts and customize these sites? These sites, again, SharePoint 2010 site definition. You can use all the techniques you use with CSS to override them, to give it your own look and feel. And also the web parts, they have been built with customization in mind. So all the web parts you saw, which started showing me my catalog information and my product information, basically render out XML, and you then use XSLD to basically structure them on screen. All the Commerce Server web parts render out XML. You can then use XSLD and basically brand them the way you want. There's a website which Kraft hosts. Kraft is a foods company. called javalia.com, which actually runs Commerce Server and SharePoint as a public-facing site. So if you're interested, you can go have a look at that. But most interestingly, we are developers, we like to see code. Microsoft's Commerce Server team shipped the entire source code with this. So you have access to the full source code, which you are free to go extend. So that makes development much more easier. You have access to all the 30 web parts, all the core services available to you in a C# project, which you can go extend. We spoke about Commerce Server, what functionality it adds in, and that makes a site, a standard brochure website, and adds commerce functionality to it. But what more? What more can we do? You know, up at the start, Will spoke about targeting content, you know, targeting content, personalizing content. And with the 2010 release, we have Fast Search integration. Fast Search gives you is a high-end search platform on the Microsoft stack, and it gives you certain features which allow you to do this. We're not going to go into a demo today, but I'll just quickly walk you through what these features are. Okay? Just a background. Fast comes from a commerce background, so from an online commerce background, so those traits are very much visible in the platform. One's called Visual Best Bets. Who's used Best Bets in 2007, 2010? It's a common feature. Yep. So think of Visual Best Bets as standard Best Bets on steroids. You can basically take any URI, like an RIA application and an image, and then put it up there with your search. So whenever people search for something, it shows that image up or the Silverlight widget. I've seen scenarios where banks put ATM locators as Visual Best Bets. So when people search for where is my bank, put a postcode in, boom, comes a widget with the actual map to that. So these are sort of scenarios that you can actually target, especially in commerce scenarios where you can say, show me the nearest store when I'm searching for something. Another big one is custom refiners. So with commerce sites, what we've noticed is you have these bimodal sites. You have sites which are extremely small, in a limited catalog, you know, probably selling 100 to 200 items, or even up to the thousands. Or you have the other ones, which are the big auction websites. And they have generally hundreds and thousands of products available at one time. And in such scenarios, the option you prefer is to go search first rather than actually browse and look through hundreds and thousands of products. And that's where Fast gives you the option to actually customize the refinement. So what you want is to refine through these hundreds and thousands of products to get to what you want. And Fast provides you with those capabilities. If you look at sites like seek.com.au, they actually run Fast at the back end to actually give you that refinement capability. Another couple of features, I remember Bill speaking about getting a Canon camera. How would you implement such a feature using SharePoint and Fast? Okay. There are these two features called as Fast Query Language and the Content Processing Pipeline, which basically allow you to massage the content as it's coming in from the search connector. So as the content comes in, you can massage them and actually get information out of it. So we could probably go out to Twitter, index Twitter for a specific hashtag, and say, okay, this is what people are buying. And then use Fast Query Language, which is a query language which allows me to lock down my search scope to go execute a very recommendation sort of search. And that way I can say, okay, Will, these are his friends. They all recommended these things. I've analyzed that. Yes, Will, I think we suggest to you not only the Canon camera, but also the tripod along with that. So you can do scenarios like that using Fast Search. So Will, do you think that's going to turbocharge SharePoint?
Oh, I should do. Lots of different scenarios. I mean, it's going to increase the look and feel of the site and target and reach and what we're trying to achieve with the website and turn it from more of a brochureware into something you can actually make money from, right? So we put the products out there, we can sell the products. All right, so the next thing we're going to look at is going that extra mile. So how do we get the reach? How do we target visually impaired people and with accessibility needs and those sorts of things? How do we actually then also scale the solution so we can actually reach that mass market that we're trying to target? So some of the things that we need to be considerate of is performance. Now, there's three areas that we're going to cover, client-side, server-side, and page weight. Do you want to look at some server-side stuff? I'll look at the client-side stuff.
Yep.
All right.
Yep. So from server-side, you know, this is what you can do on the server to improve performance. SharePoint gives you a few features out of the box, which allows you to enable caching at the server-side. Three main options that are available to you is output caching, which basically takes the HTML that gets rendered by SharePoint and sticks it into memory, and then serves it out of memory for subsequent requests. The other option is actually caching objects that are used by SharePoint underneath the hood. These can get cached as well, and they are, again, reused for subsequent calls, so you're not building objects every time. And the third one is disk-based caching. You know, a lot of content, especially images, videos, can reside in the content database. There is a big overhead for SQL Server to actually deserialize and send it back to SharePoint. If you enable disk-based caching, it will actually store this as blobs on your file system and serve it out of file system rather than going back to SQL Server. This allows you to improve the perceived performance of the site.
Thanks. So we also got in-browser caching, right? So you can turn some stuff on at the client level so we can make sure that if we rapidly push a lot of stuff out to the client to make it more performant there, we don't have to go back to the server every time to get things right. So we can really improve the performance by not having to do those round trips to the server all the time. Managing script execution. If I don't know if you know, but if you put the JavaScripts at the top of the page, they actually stop the parallelism of loading of assets and images and that sort of stuff on your page until the JavaScript file is completely loaded and executed, right? So if you move your JavaScripts to the bottom of the page, you actually can increase the performance, well, at least the perception of performance, because the things start to appear on the page quicker. So that's another thing to help with that client-side perception. Also around optimizing the static content that you're going to deliver on the website. So the images. We've got big images that haven't been optimized. We're sending down the wire. Is that a good thing? Probably not. So let's have a look at optimizing the images. Let's look at consolidating the JavaScript file so that we can bring them all together so that we've got one file coming down instead of multiple files. We're going to talk and show a few things there as well.
Optimize static content delivery as well. That's another option that you can use. Most modern browsers support generally downloading either 4 to 8 resources from a single domain. So, for example, in an e-commerce site, you might be loading a lot of images. So you're basically stuck at downloading 8 images or 8 resources at one go. So a really well-known practice is to actually split your domain into multiple domains. So you probably have your contoso.com at the root, and then you might have static content 1.contoso.com, static content 2, like that, till static content 4. And what this allows you to do basically is multiply the amount of parallel downloads that can happen. So with a single domain, you're stuck at 8. With 4, you're downloading 32 images in parallel. So you can actually get that throughput and use high bandwidth connectivity to your use. That's a really neat trick to do.
Absolutely. So page weight, JavaScript, CSS, and images.
Yep. So page weight. Page weight, basically, what we mean is the actual data that's transferred over the wire to the end user. There might be scenarios where you have to transfer a lot of data, but most of the times, you want to keep that as lean as possible. Now, there have been statistics and a lot of study done in how long a user waits before he abandons the website. Has anyone got an idea of how long does a user wait before he moves off a website?
Half a second, right?
4 seconds.
4 seconds.
4 seconds. So if you're talking about a high-performance e-commerce site, that's straight impact to your bottom line. So it's really important to make sure you're optimizing and delivering content as lean as possible over the wire.
Let's go have a look at that.
Okay, what I'm going to talk about, first I'm going to talk to you about the concepts that we're doing, what we are actually doing to optimize this and optimize the content delivery. One thing that we're doing is trying to take out JavaScript files that we do not need to send down to an anonymous user and how to do this on the fly. The second thing, we looked at and studied what Weislaw told us. It said, you're making far too many HTTP calls. You're using 6 CSS files. As a developer, you like to modularize things, but as an end user, you don't want to download 6 files. Think about sitting somewhere in middle of Alice Spring trying to download a huge file. You are going to have people moving off your website. So what we did, we looked at and basically poked around trying to see what can we do. And funny enough, I actually stumbled across a colleague of mine back at Kyandra who had built basically a minification and combination tool for ASP.NET MVC 3 and .NET 4. It basically looks at the files, combines it into one file, and sends it down, drastically improving performance. It's called as a reducer. So last couple of weeks ago, we started talking, and now we've ported that over to .NET 3.5 and SharePoint. I'm going to show you a demo of how we use that within SharePoint. First, what I'm going to do is open up the AdventureWorks website. You can go download the entire website from MSDN. It's available. It's a reference implementation meant to show you what all features. This basically has got all the features that SharePoint has got in it, wikis, blogs, in it. So what I want to show you is load up my page. It's giving me indication that there are 16 external JavaScript references. There are 7 external CSS references. So that's that itself is making 23 calls to the server to download these resources. If you go have a look at the actual amount of data that gets downloaded, I'm going to clear my cache out here. This is basically images, images, CSS, HTML, JavaScript, 1.7 meg. It's a huge download, 1.7 meg. Sitting in Alice Springs and trying to download it over wireless is not going to be fun. So what can we do to improve it? Using the tool, I've just gone in there and seen where most of the bloat is coming from. And funny enough, it's coming from images. It's coming from images. A lot of times, business users, when they author website, they add images which are really high quality. Everyone wants good-looking images, but they're not optimized for the web. I'm just going to copy that location. That's 341 kilobytes. That's a big image for being sent over the wire. How many people knew or know that SharePoint actually generates thumbnails for you behind the scenes when you upload an image to a gallery? Yep. Do you know how to get to that image? Okay, I'll show you a neat trick. Okay, Will's showing that trick now.
Is that right?
Yep.
There we go. Thumbnail.
So just appending the URL with underscore T and adding, changing the file name to whatever the file underscore extension dot the extension renders out the thumbnail for you. You can use this for all your roll-up. Rather than rescaling a 300 kilobyte image, now you're now using a 4 kilobyte image.
Bit bigger?
If you wanted a bit bigger, you can go wide.
Yep.
That renders out an optimized image, which is a bit wider. You can still see it's nowhere close to what the original size was. Okay, and I'll tell you how to use these things in a blog article, which will actually help you start keeping web content really optimized. You want to be sending this down the wire, not a 400 kilobyte image. And also, if you look at JavaScript, let's go back to my page. JavaScript, that's a lot of JavaScript. Things like SPUI, init, and the SP core are all used for content authoring. You don't need it as an end user. How can we stop the users from downloading that? So this topic started off by a well-known Microsoft MVP, and he actually came up with an idea. I've taken some of those ideas and extended it, put a UI on it to show you how we can actually optimize JavaScript and combine content using Reducer. So in this case, we've got loading things from the cache. Yep. We've got content sitting at 1.7 meg. So what I'm going to do quickly is jump into my site. Okay. And I've actually got all the wire-ups done before, so I'm just going to swap out and change my master page and CSS, master page and page layout, just to show you what the output is. I'm using unoptimized. That's what shipped out of the box. I'm just changing it to a custom master page that I've got running. Okay. I'm also going to jump into my optimizer settings. I'm going to enable JavaScript optimization. I'm going to actually take out these files. Okay. These files will only be taken out for anonymous users. I'm just going to copy the link. I've got to publish out a few pages. Now, can anyone have a guess how much the page is going to be optimized now? Any guess? We are sitting at 1.7 meg. Any guess? We've just done a few tweaks to it. We're sitting at 200 kilobytes. That's a massive, massive.
Small.
And you can see CSS, we had 7 references. It's just one file being sent down to the browser.
So I'm heading to Darwin in a fortnight, so this will be very handy.
And also what we're doing, we're aggressively caching these files on the browser. So till this file changes on the server, the browser will not re-request this file. So if I just go re-request the page, it's not downloaded. It's loaded it from my cache. I can go open it up, look at the cache settings for that file. I've given it a year-long expiry, so it's only going to expire after a year. It will never download this file for a year. Unless I change something on SharePoint, it will send on a new URL and break the client cache. So you can control when the file gets downloaded as well.
Okay. Let's switch back.
Yep.
So web standards and accessibility, what are they? Why should we care? And when should we apply them? No. So there's a lot of different things that you need to consider with web standards. You've got XHTML standards, you've got web content management accessibility guidelines for visually impairment and other accessibility needs. Out of the box, we do support some of these standards and to a certain level. But there's a lot of things that end users, when they create content, can do to break those standards, right? So we need to be moderately considerate of maintaining the accessibility levels that we need to apply in order to keep reach with our customers. So some of the tooling that we've got that covers off the web content management. Sorry about the small writing. We thought we did resize that, but must have gotten re-scrubbed. So there's a series of vendor solutions out there that handle insurance around the web content management accessibility. There's a couple of things there called Compliance Sheriff for SharePoint. Did you want to cover off these ones?
Yep.
Also the ARF, which is the Alternative Rendering Framework as well.
Yep. So what these tools basically give you is compliance management for accessibility. So you've got Compliance Sheriff, which allows you to manage compliance and W3 standards for user-authored content. You can build a site that meets these standards, but it's very easy to break them when end users are given control. You can use Compliance Sheriff to manage that. Another tool that I've used to build a fairly large internet-facing site and which managed to meet accessibility guidelines is ARF. It's again an open source project. Go have a look at it. It allows you to build highly controlled markup emitting sites on SharePoint. You can also use control adapters, which is an ASP.NET trick. Some tools, Total Validator and the W3C service. Total Validator is a client that runs on your machine. You can actually give it URLs. It will validate and tell you what's wrong, so you can go fix your markup. Also, one of the tools that we're shipping is the Model View Presenter integration into SharePoint. In our, that team also built something called as Web Assert, which allows you to run unit testing over SharePoint pages, over ASP.NET pages, and actually run W3C, validate them against W3C standards to see what's happening on pages that you build. It just gives you a quick regression testing mechanism for W3C standards.
Cool. So let's talk about scaling. Everybody's here to see the Azure stuff, right? So we've got offloading and distributed caching. So what are the technologies? We've got obviously Windows Azure, where we're going to actually create a couple of servers on-premise, and we're going to use the VM role in the cloud to actually allow us to create a single farm across the network. We're going to use a technology called Azure Connect to actually allow you to create that seamless one single farm across those environments. And also, we're going to use App Fabric. You can either deploy App Fabric on Windows Server in on-premise scenario, or you can use Windows Azure App Fabric as well in the cloud. So this is sort of visionary. It's 6 to 12 months visionary. All right. So it's not supported by us at the moment. A couple of the reasons why it's not supported: Windows Azure does not support
state. There's no state. So if your VMs get spun down, that's it. State's gone.
All right. The other thing also is that I mean, the team is looking at this. It is something we're addressing, and we're going heavy after. So, you know, it's 6 to 12 months. What we've done here is we've actually done some stuff. We've got some things working, but it's definitely not supported at this stage. But this is more about conceptual of where the hybrid model for SharePoint is going to head. All right, Sham, do you want to talk about this architecture, mate?
Yep. Just we needed an architecture slide at the end. So what I've done, or what we've done, is actually use two CTP products. Both the products we're using are in CTP, are not available for general availability. One's called VM role, which allows me to basically take an Hyper-V VHD and put it into Azure. I've got three instances of my application server now, SharePoint application server, running in the cloud. They don't have state, so if they get spun down, all configuration data is gone. So that's a caveat around that. Like Bill said, people are working around that. So hopefully we have state soon. Another piece of technology is the Azure Connect. What Azure Connect gives me is IP security transfer between on-premise and in the cloud. So I can create a virtual network and have domain-joined machines running on-premise and in the cloud. So in this case, all the demos you saw, half the server was running off my machine and half the servers are running in Azure. What I'm going to show you is a scenario where we can actually leverage this capability. This is fairly what I would say visionary or what you would be probably be doing with hybrid architectures in 6 to 12 months. One of the main scenarios we talk about is having to use elastic compute resource as we need and when we need it. So what we have done, we've just come up with a scenario where we said, okay, we're going to have a site. It doesn't look that pretty at the moment because the dev dashboard, or I want to show you something. All it does is it does a basic load calculation. You know, it sends out data to an Excel service. There's an Excel document which has got all the formulas in it. I calculate, get some input from a user, send it off to Azure to do calculation on Excel services, and send the result back. You know, think about this not for a single user but for 1,000 users. All hitting a site one. If I've got 10 Excel services instances spun up when I need them and spun down when I don't want them, that starts opening up a lot of possibilities. So what I'm going to do in this case is just go quickly, type in my name, go for it, boop. Big fat mom.
I don't want to learn much, do you?
You can also go for a ridiculous interest rate of over 30 years. That should break the bank. Okay, now this, what it's going to do, it's going to go out to Azure. Okay, there is a few network latency involved in this because when I was configuring the Azure endpoints, I actually had it relay through North America. So it's actually gone to North America and then gone to my site. So it's which will be fixed for the next demo. But you can see it's actually gone ahead and executed things against Excel services. I've used monitored scope in SharePoint, so I've wrapped my code around that, and it's taking around 8628 milliseconds to actually execute this thing and come back, which is a bit of latency, but when we start getting the network configurations proper, that will start flying. So this is a scenario where we're actually using Excel services running in the cloud and calling it from an on-premise web front end. You're the first one to see this.
Just go on.
Yeah. And the next scenario is where we've made such an expensive call, got the calculations, how do we cache this? There's another piece of technology called as App Fabric, which allows you to run caching on your premise or in the cloud. So what I've done, I've actually hooked up App Fabric as well, and I'm caching actually locally on my machine. App Fabric is called as, there's a project called as Velocity, which was kicked off, which allows me to basically have a distributed cache which runs out of process. So if SharePoint goes down for some reason, my cache is still available. That cache can be scaled up across multiple nodes. So I want my cache to be very, very highly available. I can make it available across 10 nodes. Because this is running outside SharePoint, I can also have other line of business applications reuse that cache. So in this case, I've got App Fabric turned on. I'm going to just go probably change that. Okay, go execute a call. So this is going to take again. It checks, okay, this is the first time I don't have these values cached in my server. I'm going to go to Excel, get the values and come back. And dev dashboard is saying, oh, that took a long time to calculate. You can see we're sitting at 8379. But now if I execute the same query again, it comes back very quickly. It's now falling over 1.51 milliseconds, because this is now loading it straight away from memory. This opens up a lot of possibilities when you want to get high transaction websites going in a hybrid model.
Cool. So what that was, if we have a look at our VM roles in the cloud with the Azure and the endpoints to actually make it a seamless web farm, all we've done here is we've added one of these two App Fabric environments to actually manage that cache. Could be done on-premise or it could be done in the cloud as well. So we'll skip on that. So what we've seen during today's session is really around having a look at the SharePoint WCM framework and all of the stuff that best practices and developer tools. We've looked at leveraging SharePoint Commerce to drive that next scenario and next sort of engaging website, and also that personalization frameworks and those sort of things that come with FAST. We've also looked at performing. I hope you got some good tips around limiting the weight of pages and performance improvements, and also around this this scaling through Azure, which is pretty interesting space to be watching. Obviously, we didn't show you how to do all this sort of stuff. It's not we'd need a week, but we can take questions offline and help you. And we're going to be writing a series of blog posts off this as well. Our blogs are .netbounce.com and code.jedi.net, and the integration components for Commerce Server, Reducer, and also WebForms MVP are some great resources to go out to. These slides will be made available on the TechEd website, so you don't need to take too many photos unless I'm in them. Also, yeah, that's right. Also, we're going to give away a ticket to the SharePoint conference in March in Melbourne next year, and two books. So I've got some questions. The one for the ticket, well, if you've got a business card, that'll be cool. At the end of it, we'll get your details. But the question is, what is the technology that we used to allow you to seamlessly create a hybrid web farm between SharePoint on-premise and the VM role in the cloud? Who said that? Azure Connect. Chris O'Connor. All right.
That dude said it out
there. He said it behind you, okay? I'll give it to you. All right.
That's good.
Cool. For a book, I wanted to ask a question. how many web parts does Commerce Server deliver out of the box?
30.
Who said 30 first?
This bloke.
Over there?
Yep.
All right, he's the winner, okay.
And it's technically 29, so that's fine. I should get the book.
and the next one is ask a question that's the answer for.
Oh, what's that?
Westlake.
Oh, okay.
There goes, that's the answer if you heard me.
And next, I think we'll ask another.
We'll go
based
ask
on the best question, we give away the last book.
Well, there was a good question that came through on the Twitter feed here. It said, if I can find it again, how well does TFS UI testing work in unattended mode?
So this is basically using the lab manager. Using lab, this person who asked the question in here. Okay, left. It does work, but there's a bit of work you need to do with System Center, Virtual Machine Manager to get it properly going. You need to have templated VMs to actually get it going, but it can be done. So if you hear it on the recording, yes, it can be done.
And if you're the person that asked that question, and you can tell me what your Twitter tag is, I'll give you the book.
No.
And if you're not, that's right. All right. We'll come back to that. So any other questions and that we've got from the audience, ask them. And
generally, you show like how to scale down the JavaScript and CSS file in the SharePoint. Is there any other way or tools that you can use for your standard ASP.NET website?
This will work across standard ASP.NET as well.
What
tool was that? It is basically we use something called as Reducer, which is written by one of my colleagues.
Yeah.
Which is the links out there. And another technique which I will, you know, the custom UI event where I said take these JavaScript files. That's something custom I've written which I'll make available.
What do you call it?
Reducer. Reducer. It only works with MVC.NET, MVC 3 and ASP.NET 4, and there's also a fork out for 3.5.
Hands up, who's going to the SharePoint conference in October in Anaheim? All right,
in
there
Anaheim?
Was a hand up here first. I'll give you the book. Here you go.
Okay. Evals, you need to get. Please get the evals in.
Do your evals, give us a good score, hopefully.